If you're not mad about ads, and that's fair enough, choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts, and you can hear this podcast in all its glory without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
It is podcast time. John is sitting opposite me and he is upset and affronted at parochialism and small-mindedness. But today we're going to talk big ideas, John.
Big. Go large or go home.
We're going to talk about a concept called civilization. Small, small idea. We're going to wrap it all up in half an hour odd. But I was in London this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Contemplating civilization.
Well, before we get to civilization, how was Lucy's gig?
It was fantastic. She played in the Electric Ballroom in Camden, one of the iconic venues.
It's a great venue.
It's a really good venue. Yeah. And you know when you look at the wall and you see who's played there before?
Yeah.
It's like, wow. Like, yeah, everyone has played
it's there. It's a beautiful theatre.
But it's also got a musical feel to it. You know, you can sense that there's deep musical history.
Yeah.
And
I've spent many a night there.
It's an amazing place, and people will know listening. If you're listening in London or you've been to London, you'll know Camden. You'll know what Camden means. Camden Market for music, for fashion, for everything. I mean,
Camden is
one of those parts of London that I still love, even though I'm a little bit too jaded to be going to the market now on Saturday afternoon.
But it's also a little bit touristy.
And what we always felt is we were never tourists there, even though we actually were, you know. But it was great. It was great.
She bought many a suit there, actually.
Yeah, well, exactly. But she was supporting Inhaler, and their last gig was supporting Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah.
So they're like off going stratospheric. And it was great. Lucy loved it. It was a huge crowd, and she did well. You know, it's always a hard gig to support.
It's a huge gig. Yeah.
It's a huge gig. But she's now supporting Two Door Cinema Club next month in Dublin.
Yeah.
And that's also so
brilliant.
So, you know,
they're not a great live band.
They're a great live band. I actually saw them at Electric Picnic, and they came on before the Arctic Monkeys. And this is about 5 or maybe 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah.
The big idea was Arctic Monkeys were going to steal the show. The three fellas from Donegal Day. Do you know what Donegal Day is? Yeah. Up beside Bangor.
Yeah.
It's right beside where Lucy's granny's from, actually.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
They stole the show. They were amazing.
I saw them in Bilbao.
Yes, you've been there once or twice.
I was, yeah.
And full of energy. Yeah. And full of and great pop songs. Great pop songs. Anyway, so that's that. But while I was in London.
I was traipsing the streets,
but I was staying in Kensington. And I have a posh enough place now. Mm. And I used to live for a summer in a place called Queensgate Terrace. Now, that's amazing. Listeners will find it amazing. Right?
Listeners will find it amazing
that in the mid-1980s or late-1980s, it was possible for a penniless student, think about this, to get a room in the top floor, not a room, like a shared room, in the top floor of one of those houses. Because it was before gentrification. So those houses were in 8 or 9 flats.
Weren't they student flats?
They were student flats.
They belonged to Imperial College.
Imperial College, and I hooked up with a bunch of Canadians. And they and they had managed to get a flat. But the idea is, can you imagine you could live right beside the Royal Albert Hall? I used to get up every morning and go to work.
Yeah.
I was working in a place called the Royal Kensington Hotel as the shittest barman.
Yeah.
I was so bad they used to put me in the day shift. Have you ever been in a hotel bar in the day? Nobody's there except the barman, right? Okay. But it was grand for me.
Shaking cocktails.
Shaking cocktails and reading the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times. Oh, yeah. It was one of those international things.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Devouring newspapers pretending to make cocktails. But anyway.
What'll sir have? A snake bite? Sure. Coming up.
Yes, exactly. A Bulmers. Anyway, but while I was in London, I was walking around South Ken. And South Ken, of course, is the imperial centre of London. And it's so beautiful and all the museums.
Yeah.
But it's the monuments that interest me. Like
Albert
and Victoria and all these like chinless wonders on horses who had obviously gone out and ruled the world, okay? And, you know, Clive of India. These were just like generally rapists and pillagers and terrorists who destroyed things. But of course, under everything was the moniker of civilization, that we were doing this, i.e. the Brits were doing this under the moniker of civilization. Now, if you're Irish, you've like, here. Okay, I'm not having that. Right? You don't get to get away with that. We're not getting away with it. But what fascinated me was the whole concept of European civilization and what Europeans did or have done in the name of civilization.
Yeah.
And then the idea that if you look at, for example, in London, all the British Empire are echoes to something like the Greeks and the Romans, right?
Yeah.
It's the same colonnaded stuff. It's the same ceremony. And it's this idea that we've convinced ourselves as Europeans, even us Irish people who are kind of, I just think, kind of slightly detached Europeans,
but
we have convinced ourselves that there is a direct line from the Greeks and the Romans through Western civilization, through the Renaissance, through Dante, right? Through the Reformation as well, then into the French Republic and to us, right? And I'm not talking about Europe as the EU, I'm talking about Europe as the area. And I felt this also last week when I was in Warsaw. Remember I was saying
the
whole idea of Chopin and classical music, that Europe is the great exporter of civilization to the world. This is one of our default positions. And that European civilization and Western civilization has now been exported to America. And of course, the Americans ate the whole thing. Like, what is Capitol Hill? Only a poor man's version of Rome.
Yes.
And what is Rome? Only a poor man's version in our heads of Athens, right? So this idea that we're all kind of the children of Athens, an Athenian democracy.
Okay,
and that's what gives us the right to kick lumps out of people.
Yeah.
Now, this is what happens to me on a Sunday morning after a gig, John. I know my head is melted, but I was contemplating these things, walking around.
You should just stay in bed, Mac.
I know, I should stay in bed. But if you look at all this, the idea is that there's a direct line, it's a great expression, from Plato to NATO. Right?
Oh, nice.
That direct line. So it involves science, inquiry, liberalism, democracy, all these things. And these are uniquely European. And then we have decided that this is our set of cards, so to speak. And because it's ours, this has allowed the Europeans, people from this part of the world, and we forget that we're a tiny minority, to export their ideas, number one, but also to rape and pillage the rest of the world, to extract resources. And of course, the high point of that is imperialism and colonialism. Now, as Irish people, because we were colonized, because Ireland is the proof that white people can be colonized, right? That we don't think that, we don't buy that stuff because our history is anti-colonialism, right? But in general, we're an outlier in Europe, that the majority, and I was like, also, I was listening to Macron the other day, and Macron is now talking about this made in Europe, that we have to go and find European champions, that Europe has, and I think that's fair enough.
Yeah.
But it all comes from the validation of the entire thing, is this notion that we are exceptional, and we have created something, right? It all comes to a head now in the last couple of weeks, when you see, and you mentioned to me off air as well, when you see, for example, in Ukraine, the underlying idea is not only are the Ukrainians, not only do they look like us, but they are like us because they come from this European area.
Yeah.
And again, our direct descendants are the Romans and the Greeks. And this is our intellectual tradition. And then, of course, Europeans get really shocked when Asians, the Chinese, and the Africans say, well, look, you're having this little skirmish amongst yourselves over there, you know, and I'm not too sure we have a dog in this fight.
Yeah.
You know, and this is what's having Macron making all these big speeches about Europe, because the French are thinking, shit, these people aren't with us. And the reason they aren't with us is they don't feel part of us. And in fact, our idea of civilization imposed upon them the 100 years of humiliation on the Chinese, the wholesale rape and pillage of Africa, over, you know, we've done our Caseman story. You can pick any story in Africa. Lots of Arab states saying, well, I'm not too sure about this, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, India saying, well, look, we've got to do deals with the world. This is a multipolar world. And you know what? We don't genuflect to your civilization notion because, frankly, we had our own. So these are the sort of ideas that are going through my head, John.
So are you separating Europe from the American view then as well? Or is that part of it? Is that an extension of it?
Well, I think what has happened, right? So Europe, because of the war in Ukraine, Europe has realized, oh my God, right? It's like a boomer. You know, hey, boomer.
Yeah.
Like Europe is the ultimate boomer continent, right? Yeah. And all the politicians who run Europe now were born after the Second World War.
Yeah.
So the politicians that built the European Union, the Mitterrands and the Kohls, they were all born in the war. They were children of the war. Their fathers were killed in the war. I mean, these were people who experienced deep, deep trauma. All European leaders now are born, you know, in the 50s, right? And the 60s, when things were good and life was fine, it'd be free trade, it would be nice to each other, So this kind of boomer idea, the boomers ran Europe in a sort of a cuddly, almost self-regarding, well, we're slightly superior to everybody else. And now we're at peace with each other. And look at the European Union, we've done lovely things, we don't fight anymore. But we kind of woke up about a year ago realizing, oh my God, we're completely dependent on China for goods, on Russia for energy, and on America for defense.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what are we?
Yeah.
You know, we can't defend ourselves. We can't produce stuff because we've outsourced to China. And we can't actually heat ourselves because we've outsourced to Russia. But and even if we don't outsource to Russia, you know, it's going to be outsourced to the Arab countries.
Yeah. But we have one big finger that we wag at the world.
Which is civilization.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So today's podcast is going to be on dismantling or unpicking the notion of Western civilization. And the reason the Americans are crucial in this is because, particularly in the English-speaking world, and basically what I mean is basically England and America, lots of colonialism, lots of imperialism, lots of intervention are justified on some moral superiority about, well, we are bringing Greek, Roman civilization to you guys. Look at us, democracy and liberalism and the rule of law and freedom of the press and all that stuff. Now, of course, the apotheosis of all this is the United States.
Yeah.
Because in a way, Europe has exported its power to the United States and its culture to America. And America has used that to drive what it calls Pax Americana.
Yes.
Which is the American way of looking at the world. So basically everybody is black or white, is a good guy or a bad guy. Mm. And the good guys are always the descendants of people who used to wear togas, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
in Athens, right? So, I mean, this is what I want to talk about today. And the great thing is, John, we have an amazing person to talk about these things.
All right.
We have a professor of history and archaeology from the University of Vienna. Her name is Nisha McSweeney. Irish, half Chinese. And I think this will underpin a lot of our views. She's just published a book, which I devoured when I was down. Remember I was talking about being down in King's Bar?
Yes.
When I wasn't discussing mink.
Yes.
And one-off housing, I was reading about the history of the West.
Yeah.
But it's not about the history. This is all about where Europe finds itself today, why we are confused, why the French are freaking out, right? It's because, in a way, we've persuaded ourselves we are guardians of an idea that gives us moral superiority. And maybe, as Nisha is going to explain, that idea is a total invention and is a total fabrication. And that's why we feel lost. And when the Chinese don't support us, we think, why don't you support us?
Hang
and
on
the
a
Chinese
second,
saying,
why not?
Chinese are saying, why should we support you guys? Mm. So let's go to London and let's talk to Nisha. Nisha, how are you?
I'm very well. Nice to be here, David.
Well, your book is now in Connemara. It is in Roundstone.
Okay.
I gave it, I was proselytizing for you the other day and I was like, this is an amazing book, la, 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 la. And the person I gave to, which we will not mention on air, did a very sneaky thing, just took it and said no. And which that is always a very, very good sign. Which is a very, very good sign.
Oh, I hope they're enjoying it.
Now tell us, give us the big thesis of the book.
The central argument is that the story that we tell ourselves about where the West came from, it's wrong. It's factually incorrect, and it's been disproved for a long time. And so the second question that the book seeks to address is if this is a wrong story and it's been disproved for ages, why do we still tell it? Why do we still cling to it? And the argument that the book comes up with is that it's because it's politically expedient and it suited our purposes in order to tell this story. Until now.
Until now. So what I want to do is I'm going to break this chat down to is why now has it this notion been shattered, undermined, questioned? Okay, that's the first thing. But let's go back and see, so what is the big idea? Because we were all, John and I were chatting about it, you know, Western civilization is something that I was thinking Irish people are unusual in the sense because we were colonized, we don't buy into that idea. You don't buy into, you know, well, Britain came and they were really, really nice and they were giving us civilization and roads and railways and that was great. Okay, so we don't buy that. And we've been, and you mentioned Edward Said, you know, the Palestinian thinker. We've been much more closely aligned to that thinking for a long, long time. But that makes us unusual Europeans in one way. And I know your dad is from where? Sunday's Well
in Cork, yeah, absolutely.
So you were infused with this Irish sense of the world, I presume.
From the very, very beginning. And actually, I think it was discussions with the Irish half of my family, which, you know, it helped to bring this into sharper focus over the last decades as well. And, you know, when I tell my Irish family the central thesis of the book, none of them are that surprised.
Exactly.
Yeah, we know that already. Yeah. You know that. But much of the Anglophone world still has this idea of from Plato to NATO at the core. And it's not something that's necessarily explicitly spoken. And when you question people about it, they might say, oh yeah, maybe it doesn't work or not all the pieces fit together. But it's still the out there underlying expectations, underlying school textbooks. It's in kind of Hollywood movies. It's kind of an unspoken, omnipresent cloud hanging over our historical consciousness, especially in the Anglophone, the wider Anglophone world, especially in North America.
And so the idea is that we're basically the children of Athens, is it? Give us the
you know. That's the idea. The modern West, writ large, and for which it's very different as well, where I kind of live and work in Central Europe, in Austria as well. But in the Anglophone West, that it comes, ultimately it was born from classical Greece, and that, you know, the seeds of that heritage, the threads of that heritage run through the centuries, through Rome and through kind of medieval Western Europe and then out to kind of the Atlantic world of modernity. And that's the kind of the Plato to NATO timeline.
And then, of course, you just start by saying, and the first chapter in the book is about a fellow called Herodotus, a Greek philosopher that people call the father of history. And the first thing is you're not so much even questioning this, you begin just to dismantle the theory, right? You're saying, well, he wasn't even Greek. So let's start from there. So explain how we, because it's an amazing fabrication to come up with an origin story that has no origin. That's quite an achievement, right? So explain to me how you dismantled it in the book and explain to the listeners, because it's an amazing read.
Yeah, the very, very fundamentals of the story are just totally shaky. So Herodotus is questionably Greek. So he writes in ancient Greek. He's got a Greek name. His mother's name is Greek, but we think that he was like me. He's kind of a half-breed. His dad is a Carian. They're indigenous Anatolian. They've got an Anatolian name. And he was born and brought up in what's modern-day Turkey in Halicarnassus. And so we know that when he gets to Athens, he gets to an Athens which is becoming, there's no other way to put it, increasingly racist. It's Athens, which is expanding an empire, what is actually an empire, and it's restricting citizenship rights to people who can claim to citizen Athenian parents, and it's disenfranchising people. It's cultivating a hostile environment for migrants. And it's, despite being quite successful in Athens as a writer, Herodotus eventually leaves. And, you know, I can only imagine that part of the reason that he leaves is because it's just a really uncomfortable place to be as an immigrant. And he ends up going further west, small town in southern Italy, retiring by the Italian coastline, which sounds lovely. I think I might try that myself sometime.
Well, listen, the book's selling well. The book is selling well. All you need now is a TV deal and a podcast, and away you go.
Ah, sorted.
Then you can do it from anywhere. But then you have to hang out with old mates for ages, which is really difficult.
Oi, I hear.
But listen, you just mentioned one thing. You said you felt a bit of a half breed. So is the fact that you're half Cork, half Chinese, is that part of the way in which you look at the world?
I think, yeah, absolutely, fundamentally. As you said, the Irish are not fully part of the West in this kind of the power games of the West as it's come through. So I've always had that from young. But also because, my mother is Chinese, my sister, she still lives in Shanghai. I spent part of my childhood in Malaysia and, you know, I'm partly Asian too. And so I am definitely of the West, but I think this is what the modern West is now. It's comprised of a whole bunch of people who have different geographic roots and origins, and it's a diasporic West as well, and the Irish are all over the world now, and I think that's part of what the West is, and that's partly why we have to rethink the identity of the West in the 21st century, because it's no longer what it was at the beginning of the 20th century.
And it's fascinating in the book the way you go to Baghdad. Now tell me about these kind of scientists in Baghdad, these mathematicians, these philosophers, and you go to Southern Africa, you take these characters who not only undermine the thesis, but are an affront to the thesis that there is this direct lineage between us, the Greeks, and the Capitol Hill in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. I think some of the people who would now seek to defend Western civilization would find it very offensive almost to think of these people as being part of the history of the West, but they absolutely are. So, you know, I've got a chapter on a medieval Islamic scholar called Al-Kindi, who was an amazing mathematician and an astronomer, a doctor, a kind of a physicist. But he also developed this theory about knowledge, and that knowledge is not confined to people of a particular civilization or a particular race. It's something that should be shared by all humanity. And he was very strong in arguing this. And he played a big role in preserving the texts of especially Greek antiquity and building on Greek science and Greek maths and Greek knowledge and bringing that through into the medieval period. And this is something which I think, you know, maybe quite a few people are increasingly aware of nowadays, but the central role that the Islamic world played in the transmission of knowledge through time and in the Western story, we might know it, but it's not part of the grand narrative of Western civilization. We've kind of written that bit out of history, of Western history. And that's true as well of a lot of the African inputs into Western history. And you mentioned the African chapter, and that's it's focused on this amazing woman called Ning Jinga, who is a warrior queen in modern day Angola, and she fights against the Portuguese very successfully. It's incredible how successful she was, but one of the elements in her success is not just that she's a great general, it's also that she very strategically deploys kind of international diplomacy, and she uses religion and Christianity. But there is also this thread of the appeal to a Western heritage, and she's deemed so successful that you've got people writing about her as an heir to Western civilization. They say that she is as wise as an ancient Greek, as chaste as a Roman. So despite being an African queen who is fighting against European imperialism, she's still able to be described as an heir of Western civilization, which I think is pretty remarkable in the 17th century, but unthinkable now.
But yeah, I mean, particularly it's coming from the Portuguese, who would have actually, you know, staked their claim as being, well, we are the inheritors of Christian civilization. We're going down to, you know, civilize the natives. And they are the idea that, hold on a second, one of the natives is far cleverer, far smarter, far more diplomatic, could actually speak Portuguese as well as are many other talents, you know, and they were, you know, these guys were not being able to speak the indigenous languages of Angola at the time. So it is fascinating how what you've done is you've kind of usurped this whole notion. But what I want to ask you now is, why do you think now are Europeans and Americans, you know, for example, if you think in the war in Ukraine, there's a kind of people are kind of shocked, like, oh my God, the Indians don't support us? Are the South Africans might support the Russians? Or the Chinese are playing their own game because they're a huge power? Why do you think that now this thesis becomes very, very resonant?
I think it's the question of there's a big gap between powers that are used to exercising influence over others and peoples who are used to having power exercised over them. And you can see absolutely why lots of the world would feel really uncomfortable at one of the major world global powers saying, carving the world up and saying this can or cannot align itself with different ways. And it's just different forms of imperialism acted out in different ways. And, you know, the way that some of the Ukraine conflict has been cast is not necessarily listening to the voices of the African nations and Asian nations as well, who are treading a very careful line, I think, between understanding different forms of colonialism. And it's very different. The story that we're getting in the English-speaking press is perhaps a bit different from even what we're getting in different parts of Europe.
Now, I noticed in the book you elevate and you talk about Carrie Lam of Hong Kong. Tell me about her, because she was kind of has been much denigrated in the West as sort of Xi's almost terrier in Hong Kong. And you think, well, hold on a second, look at the big picture.
Yeah, I think she also was, she didn't get an easy ride of it in China either, in the Chinese press, because she was viewed as somebody who didn't have a strong handle on the situation. So she's a person who was, you know, caught very much between two stools, caught between two worlds. And again, she starts out her political career as somebody who's got British citizenship as well as, you know, Hong Kong citizenship, Chinese citizenship. But in the idea of East and West coming together is a really positive thing when she starts out her career. And that's how she wants to sell Hong Kong as this wonderful place where the best of East and West join. But over the course of her career, it just becomes harder and harder to do this. And, you know, the East and West are going in different directions. She gets a bad press in the West for stamping down on pro-democracy protesters, the pro-democracy protesters think that she's a puppet of Beijing. Beijing thinks that she is a weak leader who is incapable of managing the protests. And she's not able to make anyone happy, really. So she's, again, caught between the stools and not being able to try and tread the line and serving two masters. I think there's one thing she said herself, that it's really hard to serve two masters. And I can just imagine now she's retired, that she's probably a bit of a rest.
Yeah, but in a way, like, she's emblematic of this cleavage between the old West and the old East, in effect, and then this new cosmopolitan world. I mean, how do you think the West is going to have to reconfigure its thinking to deal with the fact that we are old? You know, Europe is like kind of the boomer continent, right? We're old. Kind of many people would disparage Europe as being sort of half nursing home, half museum. And then we look at Asia, it's a totally different feel. Like, I haven't been to Asia for years, but every time I've been there, you just feel this mad bustling energy, like mad, you know, like that it's coming up from the ground almost. And how do you think this is going to play out over the next couple of years?
I think the only thing that we sitting in Europe can do is to accept it. And to try and make you know, accept and make the best of it. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Changing the scales of global power and the dynamics of the global economy is not necessarily a bad thing, and it shouldn't be viewed with fear and suspicion. This is terrible. As you say, it's still a part museum, but that's something that Europe really has. It's got that kind of strength of cultural traditions, which is very dangerous in a world where funding is being cut to cultural institutions and the arts, when actually those are some of the things that Europe is strongest on and that it uniquely has. And those are things it should be, if anything, focusing on and capitalizing on and trying to celebrate and bring up. So I think that would be a key element in going forward, as well as the acceptance of a changed political and economic reality. I think it was only just a few weeks ago that the BRICS countries outstripped the G7 economically. And, you know, that's the reality now. We're now living in that world. And to try and turn back the clock is going to just lead to misery as well as failure.
Well, just so the BRIC countries, just for those of you, that's Brazil, Russia, India and China.
And South Africa.
And of course, South Africa are in hot water now with the Americans because they're equivocating on which side they're on. They're kind of saying, well, we're not really on any side. And that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That the Europeans, Americans are demanding the rest of the world take sides, and the rest of the world is saying, well, look, we're not taking a side here.
Yeah, and that's, I think it's part of the kind of the old world order is this rhetoric of the West and the rest. And I think increasingly large numbers of the world no longer want to split the world into two, the West and the rest. They want to have a much more multipolar world where there are different blocks and it's not just one and the other, black and white, us and them. And I think that's part of the thinking that we probably in the West need to get out of. It's not us and them anymore. It's just more plural out there.
Well, Nisha, you're coming to obviously the epicentre of multipolarism, which is the Doki Book Festival in a couple of weeks' time. I can't wait to talk to you then.
Can't wait to be there.
Yeah, no, we'll have a total hoot, but the book is an extraordinary achievement. It's brilliant and it's also incredibly well written. And for someone like me, who's a sort of a generalist, you know, it's like it's written for punters like me who are kind of curious but don't really have any insight into almost anything. Is that right, John?
That's absolutely right.
So, Alicia, we will see you in Dorking in a couple of weeks' time. Thanks so much.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, Mark, so everything I know about Western civilization has all been fake news, has it?
All the way going back to Herodotus, going back to Athens, old windbag himself, Cicero.
Yes, indeed. But do you remember just before we were talking to Nisha there, we were talking about London. And when I was there last month, I went to, as I was telling you, the British Museum, which of course is full of all the treasures from around the world, from the Elgin marbles to, you know, stuff from Africa and the Far East and the Middle East and South America and,
do you
and
ever,
everywhere.
Do you ever think about why the Brits were robbing stuff from Egypt and the Egyptians weren't robbing stuff from Britain? Because there was nothing fucking in Britain to rob. Or Ireland, right? So think about it, right? You know, the Elgin marbles, all those great things. The reason our museums are full of their stuff is their civilizations are much older than ours.
Yeah.
And this is the whole idea.
But it's not even so much that they're older, it's just that...
But they were more sophisticated. They were much more sophisticated. What they had was much more... So their craftsmanship, their mysteries.
But it's more they're just getting on with stuff, you know?
But the point
is
the reason that the Brits were robbing historical artifacts from the rest of the world is historical artifacts were there. Now, why were they there? They were there because these were really civilized places.
Yeah. No,
these were incredibly economically vibrant places and intellectually vibrant places, you know? And this, I suppose, is the point that what we've done. And we're in a way lucky in Ireland. And I think Nisha is right, because it doesn't come as a surprise to Irish people to hear that the West, be they French or Germans or Brits or even the Yanks, right, have used stories to justify occupying other countries. And at the end, that's what colonialism is.
Yeah.
You know, the role of the colonizer is to basically rob the colony. That's why you're there. You're not there to... for the crack.
Yeah, and I suppose ultimately it was for a profit. But there are many points that Nisha brought up that we could explore. But it was this whole idea of colonialism was kind of under the guise of bringing civilization to you, we're giving you all these ideas of democracy and capitalism and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I was wondering that, you know, you were asking Nisha, why now? You know, why the West is being challenged now, or more now than before?
Yeah.
And I was wondering, is it because we're kind of weaker now, or seen as weaker? You know, the democratic system and, well, our economic structure is not exactly working great at the moment.
Yeah.
And that, along with kind of our Western religions and our cultures, is faltering, you know, with economic crashes and the wealth gaps and the arrogance and the obvious double standards in society is even less appealing now to, you know, non-Western societies, and cracks are showing.
Well, I think,
and is that the reason why people
I think
are
it
going?
Is. I think, look, you know, there's one thing about doing a podcast like this over the last few years. You kind of are doing a podcast in an age of anxiety. There's no doubt of that.
Mm.
In an age where things that we thought were permanent are much more fragile than we imagined. Geopolitical settlements, like, you know, when we were kids, was things like the first and the third world.
Yes.
We were kind of the second world. We were kind of stuck somewhere in the, you know, right? And there was the Cold War, and there was the communist bloc, and then there was the capitalist bloc. And it was all pretty straightforward. Like, you knew where you stood. And then you have, of course, at the end of the Cold War, you have this brief period of American superpower hegemony, right?
Yeah.
And the Americans seemed to blow that, because they were in a position, certainly before the Iraq War, to basically dominate the world and to recreate this Pax Americana, and they didn't do it. And in fact, America has gone the other way. And then, of course, with the emergence of China, which is not just an economic challenge, it's a philosophical challenge. It's an intellectual challenge. It's an historical challenge, and it's a political challenge. Because what China is saying is, we don't do democracy, and we're here. We don't do freedom of the press.
We never did.
And we're here.
Yeah.
And we have been a unified political entity for 3,000 years. Just to give you a sense of how unified China has been, right? China, in terms of the way in which it's governed now and the way in which it's entirely broken up, etc., would be like Europe being run by the pharaohs. Right. Imagine that. There's been such continuity in China. Right?
Yeah.
Yes, of course, there have been different dynasties, and now you had the communist dynasty, which is in effect a dynasty, but the centralized power of China is run in very much the same way. So that is a massive challenge to us. And the Ukraine war is just the latest of a series of exposures, in a way, of the fault lines between Europe and America, who believe that because we've decided to tell a series of porkies about where we came from, that we have some overarching story that makes legitimate our position in the world, and the rest of the world, which is now saying, do you know what? You guys are about 10% of the world's population.
Yeah.
We're the 90%. We've got a different story. And that's it.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.